on the nature of nature. What else would you talk about on a day as refulgent as this, with the sun shining off of the needles and the sky is beautiful and it didn't snow, and I know some people are disappointed by that, and it just shows that you can't make everyone happy all of the time. Sometimes it snows, sometimes you get sun, and that is part of the nature of nature, which is change. And part of the nature of humanity is, I don't like change. And so we are right off the bat dealing with all kinds of really interesting contrasts in our relationship with what we see as nature. One of the great years I had was a year, a couple of years ago, when we went and had the experience of fire and ice. We went for the ice to Alaska, and the colors were stark. It was white, it was gray, it was blue-gray. And the scale was enormous. There were these huge glaciers, and the thicker the glaciers were, the denser the ice. The white turned to blue almost imperceptibly, and it was magical. We saw glaciers calving, which is how they give birth to icebergs. Part of the glacier falls off, and it's not just a chip of ice. It looks like an entire city block. It goes into the bay and then pops back up to the surface, and waves roll across the bay. And the power and the simplicity and the starkness of it. The same year we went to Costa Rica, which was a marvel and a completely, it was like in The Wizard of Oz. When Dorothy finds out, she opens up the window to the cabin, and the cabin is in black and white. And she looks through the window, and it's all color. And she goes, gee, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore. And we're in Costa Rica, which is a land of fire and of color, of volcanoes, of Tabacón, of Arenal. Beautiful, beautiful, powerful, fierce, raging volcanoes, letting out steam and lava and fire. A place of where nature is beautiful in its colors that are indescribable, where nature also plays tricks. Mm-hmm. Nature is not a straight shooter. There are plants that pretend that they're animals. They have evolved, if that word offends you, I'll get to design in a minute. They have evolved to look like insects so that other insects will come and pollinate them. Your parents will explain when you're 12, and then you can explain to them. There are trees that walk. They're walking palm trees. The tree doesn't get its sun. It sends out roots. It loosens roots, and it will slowly walk to find its place in the sun. Nature is so amazing when you look at the complexity, at what evolution is. You go around the world and you see birds that think that they're fish, that swim and don't fly. You see flying fish. You see walking twigs. You see a whole world of masquerade, of convergent evolution, of things that come together in order to fit into an environment and to make a way of life, a modus vivendi, to make a kind of rough peace with nature. I will cut to the chase. The meaning of my sermon today is we need to learn how to make that rough peace with nature, because human beings have not learned how to do this yet. We get caught up in the natural wonder, and believe me, I understand the attraction of the argument from design. When you look at how systems interrelate, how they interconnect, you go, wow, how could that happen? You look at the complexity of a human being, of all of the systems, that anything ever works is just miraculous. There's an old Orthodox Hebrew prayer that men say before praying. It's a prayer before praying. It's kind of a meta thing. And it is thanking God for returning the soul to the body after a night's sleep. And what it really means is it's an acknowledgement of the miracle of where we journey at night in our dreams, and then we come back and we're ourselves. And we're such a delicate balance that keeps us momentarily sane and compensating and reacting appropriately with our environment. And it's so easy to go off. And all of our systems, from every individual human being to the world out there, are fragile, interconnected systems. There is so much going on in each of us that it's hard not to just go, wow, it's just amazing. And the poetry of design is something that I'm completely in sympathy with. But it's poetry. It's not science. I can look at a lunar eclipse and say, you know, that is the dragon that is eating the moon. And that can make a really nice story, and it's good for the kids, but it doesn't let you really help predict eclipses in the future or chart the stars. It's a good story, but it's not science. If you follow that story and you don't do the astronomy, you end up feeding the dragon. And that might make a really good religion in Southern California, but it really won't help advance the cause of humanity. So to stand in awe and wonder at nature, and also to try to understand it and to work with it, are not opposites. They are just two different places to stand. Two legitimate ways of relating to nature. And it's really important that we not get caught up in the great romanticizing of nature, because we tend to look at nature as something that is just by its nature perfect. And nature is, when we're here in the middle of a beautiful forest and we have the scent of fresh air and of leaves and pollen and mold. Nature is just nature is something that fills us with awe and sometimes mucus and the thing is, nature is not your mother. Nature is trying to kill me. And it's creation, but it's also destruction. It's the creation of the sun, but it's the nova of the sun, and it's trying to get me. And it's trying to get you and your little dog Toto. And in this Eden, there are snakes and coyotes and bears, and we're very happy you didn't meet any of the three of those, Dick, last night at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning when you were laying underneath the set moon in the middle of the road. Man is not wise by nature. It's a learning process. We romanticize nature, but nature is tough. And nature is not fair. And nature is also not cruel. It is amoral. There's a wonderful line in The Godfather where the fellow has tried to kill the Godfather, and he says, you know, tell Mike it wasn't personal. Well, it's not personal, you know? Gravity isn't personal. Aging isn't personal. Entropy isn't personal. Novas and supernovas aren't personal. The universe is not out to get you. It's just out to get you. I mean, it just will get you, but it's not out to get you, because that's the nature of nature. And what we have to do is to find a way. And the problem with most human beings is that we divide our worlds in half, into the holy and the profane. We divide our worlds in half into the good and the bad. The good people, the bad people, the good policies, the bad policies. And accommodation and negotiation is so hard. I find it interesting and not accidental that we have put nature in the feminine. And because my first sermon back in, well, they were using Roman numerals then, but the first sermon that I gave was on the role of women in religious myth. And the thing that I noticed was that there was a tendency to put women on pedestals and then to put the pedestal in the middle of a home and to lock the doors. That when we romanticize something, we tend to isolate and to control it. And there are two primary reactions that our society has with nature. One is romantic, pristine, it's perfect. Don't despoil it. And the metaphor is really clear. It's a sexual metaphor. The other is, well, let's just tear it all down. The 19th century and half of the 20th century, the greatest thing that man could do was to carve out a niche in nature, to conquer nature, to drain the swamps, to build up the cities, to raise up those great symbols of our intelligence and wisdom and ingenuity, the smokestack, to cut down the forests and to cut down the groves, and then to name the housing development after the thing that you have just destroyed. So Cypress Garden doesn't have a cypress in it. Thousand Oaks should be renamed Two Oaks. That's what we do. We have these extremes of you either conquer it or you worship it from afar. There are people that want to keep you out of the forest. There are also people that want to turn the forest into all condos. There's a middle way. It doesn't have to be war or surrender, but accommodation, mature love, learning how to be in a relationship with nature, not to dominate it. I'm a sailor, and I know there's, where's my other sailor here? I know there's another sailor here, and you know that when you're on the sea in a sailboat or even a large ship, that sea is much more powerful than you are. It can kill you in a second, but you have a chance. You have a chance because you have intelligence, you have some tools for working with it, but you don't control it. You can only make a modus vivendi with it, a way of trying to live, to use the winds, to use the tides, to help guide ourselves safely as we can through all of the great forces of nature. They're not for our conquest. The great religious question, the great scientific question, the great philosophical questions are, where do we come from? We don't know. Whether it's the Big Bang or whether it is, let there be light. Somebody will figure out a difference between the two of those. But the point being, we don't know the moment before. And where will it end? Will it end in fire as the expansion of the universe contracts back into another hot singularity? Or will it end in ice as entropy conquers all and our universe, there may be multiverses, but our universe turns cold? Fire and ice, they're both natural. They're both endings that we don't have control over, and with any luck at all, we will not personally see. But they are the great questions that science and philosophy and religion all wrestle with, and they're about the nature of nature. Where do we come from? How shall we be here with nature and with each other? And how does it all end? What we do know is this, and for a moment it's enough. We are here. We are here now in this beautiful setting with each other, with adults and children and a spectrum of ages and a spectrum of beliefs. We are here with our own myth, our own fantasies, our own beliefs. And we are, for this moment, we know, a flash of light in the darkness of the universe. We are a flash of light that has warmth, intelligence, occasional wisdom. And while the light is on, each of our sparks can warm another human being, can illuminate our little corner of creation, and can glow for the moment of this existence that we share together. Here endeth the sermon. And Jim, I forgot to turn the recorder on. So starting again, fire or ice? That put the fear of the Lord into you, didn't it? I'm looking at Mike Mahaffey going, oh dear God, no. I've never seen him pray before, actually. See, everybody prays. It's just a question of for what. This is going to be a brief time now. First for words of, single word we decided in the planning committee. Try making Unitarians fit in between the lines. Instead of the normal kind of sharing and question and statement time, if anyone has a word, a single word of appreciation for a falling leaf that fell in Juana's hand, a gift from the sky to share about this weekend, this would be a nice time just to say, wow.
A sense of community.
Oh, my gosh. Amazing.
Community, amazing, gosh.
Wow.
Wow. Jeepers.
Warmth and acceptance.
Warmth, acceptance.
Clarity.
Clarity.
Beauty.
Serenity. You're going for seconds when people haven't had their first.
Jiminy.
Understanding.
Family. Music. Music and family.
Nature.
Who would have thunk? Well, one of the ways that we can show our appreciation for nature and for this amazing Unitarian Universalist camp up here in the hills, this model of what the sermon was about, of accommodation. It isn't wilderness camp, and it isn't condos and high rises. It is the model of an accommodation to give us an experience of nature within the comfort levels of people of all different ages and abilities, and it's a very important place for us with family and serenity and music and inspiration and warmth and community and all of those things within a setting of fire, unfortunately, of warmth, thank goodness, sometimes of ice, and all of the phases of beauty. So when we come to take the collection is not for the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fullerton, and the collection is not for the Chalice Society. The collection is for De Benneville Pines. And there are several ways of giving. You can drop small change in here, and if I hear any, you're excommunicated. You can put in large bills and checks, or you can also be a campfire lighter, which is a promise, to the extent you're able, nobody sells the paper, to pledge $800, $100 a year for 8 years to De Benneville Pines so that the capital improvements can go on, so that the programs can go on, so that these wonderful services and the fabulous leadership from Janet and all of this can go on, not simply for us. This camp was a... For most of us here was a gift that Ray Manker worked and toiled and sweated to get for the Unitarian Universalist Association and for the Pacific Southwest District. It is a legacy to us. An earlier generation worked and paid, and now the torch is passed to a new generation, and it's our turn to make sure that it remains, it is maintained, and it is improved. This is our chance to leave a legacy, and I don't want to ask you to do anything I'm not willing to do myself, so this is my campfire lighter's pledge. We have forms to fill out if you care to join that program, and I hope that many of you will join with us. Dick Cole, who's on the board, has helped put this program together, and the better we can model it for other congregations, the better it will be for everyone in this district. So be a part of the process and of the family of the Bentonville Pines.